Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks. Well, today we have regular contributor and good friend Joanne Barefoot joining us. Joanne is chair of the Alliance for Innovative Regulation, CEO of Barefoot Innovation Group, host of the Barefoot Innovation Podcast, and she was former deputy comptroller of the currency. Joanne, welcome. Always great to have you on the show. And we're gonna focus on the U.S. A little bit, at least in our segment here, because we're in the very early days of a Biden-Harris administration, certainly very different than a Trump-Pence administration. We've got new faces coming in. We'll talk a little bit about who some of those people are, but more importantly, what kind of changes should, you know, whether you're a banker, whether you're a fintech innovator or an investor in this space, what kind of things do we think are new coming down the road?
Yeah, great. It's great to be back, JP. Good to see you. So I think that we should be kind of fastening our seatbelts. I think we're going to see a lot of activity in Washington. Obviously, we have a lot of division. We've had a lot of gridlock in many areas where the ball hasn't moved that much in recent years. And I think that now that there is Democratic control of the White House and both houses of Congress, we're likely to see faster movement in a lot of areas where there's been activity in the past. I think Washington will increasingly be important to our listeners, maybe more so than in recent years, because I think a lot's going to be going on here.
Well, it feels to me a lot like the early days of the Great Recession, and where we had, you know, some things that were put in place at the end of the Bush administration, and then when the Obama administration came in, there was a lot of kind of cleanup. And, you know, of course, Dodd-Frank was started before that. It took a long time to take effect. And we have a lot of Dodd-Frank veterans that are coming in to this. I'm going to start with maybe one of the biggest names on the list, at least, Janet Yellen. Secretary of Treasury, and she has been confirmed, so she's officially in that role. And, you know, she previously had been head of the Federal Reserve, where she replaced Ben Bernanke at a time of great crisis, or coming out of that crisis. So in 2014, we were well in our way to a recovery. What lessons do you think Janet Yellen might take from that bit of history as we apply it now? We've got financial crisis going on, but that's not driven by the financial sector. It's really driven by a global pandemic.
Yeah, it's a great question. So one of the questions that's most on the front burner is how will the administration scope the pandemic rescue package that's under discussion as we speak? And listeners have probably been hearing the back and forth on whether the prior one was too small, the one during the Great Recession. It certainly looks like the Biden administration and Secretary Yellen are going to be trying to be very aggressive. The president has been saying we're in more danger of going too small than too large.
Right. So
seems likely there will be a lot of money across the board. Whether there'll be bipartisan compromise on it, as we're talking today, is yet to be seen. But so that would, among other things, mean more money in the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP, and more opportunity for banks and some fintechs to be trying to help with that type of problem, as well as seeing money coming to their customers who are in danger of sinking in the financial moment that we're in.
Yeah, and speaking of the PPP, so first of all, there's the program itself as a way of getting money to small businesses that need it. So should we anticipate another round of funding for PPP or other kinds of stimulus like that?
I think these kinds of stimulus are definitely going to be happening, that there's still money left in the PPP. So exactly how they're going to handle it is yet to be seen. But there's definitely going to be the will to take care of Main Street and not let another round of small businesses be destroyed. And in that process, there's also been a spotlight on the SBA and other agencies' technology, internal technology, and their ability to ramp up and deliver these kinds of things. I think that'll be a topic as well.
Well, and I'm wondering if a current administration might think more about more direct stimulus or support rather than kind of routing through a loan program through thousands of banks.
Support for banks or for people?
Well, for people, that's why I say when you think about PPP, so the idea is, hey, we've got employees of small businesses that aren't able to work because businesses are closed because of the pandemic. In the prior administration, there wasn't a lot of appetite for direct support. And so what we came up with is, well, your boss should go to a bank and apply for a loan. The loan will have government support and can even be forgiven by the government. But we've got to push this through a loan application from a bank, which has been, I think, you know, both a positive and a negative for the banks. The ones I've talked to have been, you know, kind of overwhelmed by the labor that it took to get those loans done and the kind of lack of clarity around the rules and, you know, changing it at the 11th hour and all that. But at the same time, it also created some new customers. So I know a lot of banks are focused on kind of leveraging what came in as a PPP loan application. You know, can that be a long-term customer for the bank? So that's like piece one is we're trying to get money to support small businesses. And so, you know, my last question was, you know, will we continue to push it through the CARES Act and PPP, or will there be new routes that go, you know, in form of more direct aid?
Well, clearly we're going to have more direct money for individuals, and we're working on both the amounts of those and the eligibility criteria.
Right.
So that is going to be one of the major points of contention. But finding the best ways to get money to small businesses is not that easy. The Main Street program that was in the original CARES Act has had trouble getting traction. And so from my standpoint, it remains to be seen exactly how we're going to be the most effective and efficient with it.
Right. And then the second part of that is you know, the enforcement. And I want to broaden that conversation to other kinds of enforcement and new rulemaking, but staying on PPP for a minute. Again, going back to the financial crisis and things like TARP were put in place for the banks, which seemed like a good idea at the time. And then it did feel like when a new administration came in, suddenly banks were being examined, asked questions, and even sometimes criticized around things that, you know, were kind of done in the heat of the moment to solve a crisis. And I worry that that kind of happens again here with PPP, right? There's been plenty of reporting of abuse and some outright fraud, some maybe the faults of some of the banks, some maybe not, more of a just poorly designed program or rushed program at least. So any thoughts on how a new administration might come thinking about how do we examine PPP from the banks who put out those loans?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we heard many banks express that concern at the launch of the PPP, remembering the TARP situation and fearing being second-guessed. And then, as you know, thousands of banks stepped up and got these loan guarantees arranged. I read the other day some speculation, for example, that possibly banks would be criticized on fair lending disparate impact grounds if they preferred their existing customers at first as opposed to just opening their doors for new applicants. That's the kind of thing that makes banks worry about participating in a government program if the rules are not sufficiently clear up front. So I think this does remain to be seen. If these crises take a pattern that's very common where everyone rushes to step up and solve the crisis moment. And then as you go through later, you realize that things were done wrong that maybe should have been foreseen or maybe couldn't have been. But they do tend to come back to sometimes to haunt these kinds of programs.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking about. Well, let's go outside of PPP. What else should we expect in terms of enforcement and rulemaking? What kinds of areas have you been paying attention to that you think Washington will start paying a little bit more attention to now?
Yeah, so we certainly expect a big upsurge in enforcement activity, and particularly around consumer protection. Rohit Chopra has been, that name has been brought forward to head the CFPB, and he, of course, was there at the beginning and then went to the Federal Trade Commission and would be coming back. And I think we'll see a lot more focus on enforcement activity. And I also think we'll see rulemaking as well in areas that are of particular concern to consumer advocates. There's a lot in flight right now on small dollar lending, those kinds of issues. I also think we'll see activity around the bank chartering issues. In recent years, there's been multiple efforts to change to soften the line between banks and non-banks to some extent and bring more innovative fintechs into the banking system where they might be somewhat more rigorously regulated, although our friends at the state bank regulators would certainly agree that they do plenty of oversight of these companies. But one of the issues that raises is the potential for fintech companies to be receiving national bank charters by one means or another that would enable them to be able to bypass state usury laws. And the state usury laws are a huge concern to the consumer advocates. So I think one way or another, there'll be an effort to prevent that particular thing from happening very much. But the chartering overall, the effort to figure out how to bring the innovation engine of the consumer financial space, some of it inside the banking system, even if it's through traditional national bank charters or state bank charters, as has begun to be done, I think that is likely to continue.
What about data and privacy? You've talked and written a lot about that lately. What's on the horizon for that around enforcement and also rulemaking?
Yeah, so this is an area where I really hope the audience will pay a lot of attention going forward. The United States has been slower than other parts of the world to develop comprehensive privacy and data control laws. And we work with little pieces of those that universe of rules. And it seems likely to me that the next few years will bring major legislation and regulation on privacy and the rules of the road on using data. With the Senate now becoming controlled by the Democratic Party, we have a new Senate Banking Committee chairman, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, and he had a draft privacy bill out for comment last fall, and he and others are considering the possibility of creating a separate agency for managing data regulation and privacy protection. And something to be conscious about is that there are a lot of people in the financial industry and the fintech sector who sort of take for granted that what they're doing is good for the customer, that it's going to bring a lower price or more access or make it easier to qualify for a loan that you really can repay, make it easier to do faster payments, the whole litany of work that your listeners engage in. And that assumption is not necessarily shared. There's a lot of concern about the potential downside of not just what fintech companies are doing, but fintech innovation more broadly. What's the risk that we're going to have bias in algorithmic loan underwriting? What's the risk of full loss of privacy? In the wake of the insurrection, we have a full rising set of concerns about the surveillance state, whether or not the government should be able to, and private companies should be as able as they are today to track us through data that we don't even know is being shared. So I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of work in this space, and it will greatly change both banking and fintech. And I really recommend that people be taking this moment to ask yourself, if you find yourself under new scrutiny on how you're using data, this is the time to be sure that you can shine a light on that and be proud of what that story is, how you gather it, how you store it, how you share it, how you use it, whether your methodologies are explainable. People are interested in explainable AI, and how you test and validate tools like this to be sure that they're fair and they're not introducing racial and gender bias and other kinds of bias into what you're doing. It's really, really critical. It might be the biggest issue ahead.
Well, I think that's great advice. And maybe as we start to wrap this up, I'll ask you very broadly here. As you mentioned that the U.S. is behind a lot of countries in the data and privacy areas, and we also have an approach different than a lot of the countries in Europe and in Asia, for instance, where some of the rulemaking is not just proscriptive and creating what must not be done, but sometimes also more prescriptive on things that must be done, you know, things like PSD2 in Europe, which in made a part of the rules that banks needed to expose certain pieces of customer data to open that up to fintechs. That sure seems like a big change here, but we are in a time of big change. Do you think that some of the new rulemaking might force some access or force, whether you're a fintech or a bank, kind of require more openness or ability to use data?
I do think so. I think we're going to see a very active regulatory period ahead, and likely we may have more principles-based regulation as well. But yes, I think we could have more prescriptive rules in a lot of priority areas. I think there'll be tremendous effort to deal with the racial equity gap and gender gap as well, to try to figure out how to get more capital and more credit to people who need and qualify for it. I think we're going to see something that'll be fairly new in the U.S. with a lot of interest in green finance that is also quite advanced in other parts of the world and not so much here. And I think there'll be a lot of focus on what should banks and other entities be doing to foster green finance, to reduce their own carbon footprints, to deal with risk. I think there's some thorny issues. There is already concern among regulators about whether banks are too exposed to areas and sectors that have a lot of climate risk, climate change risk. And that is a fraught issue because many of those vulnerable areas are lower income areas or areas with more Black and brown populations. And we won't want to see them being de-risked in the way we sometimes have seen in the anti-money laundering space. Very complicated issues, but I think that will be one of the focuses. I also think on financial crime, we're likely to see a lot of interest in the domestic extremism issues that have arisen since the attack on the Capitol building. And so that may be another area where we'll see some shift. Our laws, domestic laws, are different from our international laws on anti-money laundering. That could change, actually. But with or without it, I think there's going to be a lot of interest in figuring out how to deal with internal instability here in the U.S., and not just global issues.
Well, clearly, still unfolding. We're early in the story here, but I think we do have a lot of new things to think about, whether you're a banker, whether you're a fintech entrepreneur, whether you're an investor in the space. I think regulation had been kind of on the back burner for the last 4 years, and I suspect that's no longer the case. So, Joanne, as always, thanks for joining us to share your experience and your perspective. Always glad to have you on the show.
My pleasure.
This show is brought to you by Privacy. Start the new year off right by making your digital life more secure. Privacy lets you buy things online using virtual cards instead of having to expose your real card number, protecting your identity and bank information on the internet. Right now, new customers will automatically get $5 to spend on their first purchase. Go to privacy.com/breakingbanks to sign up now. With Privacy, you can control your subscriptions and recurring payments to make sure you're never accidentally billed twice or upgraded to another service without your consent. Save time with a Chrome or Firefox extension. Fill out all of your virtual card information with just one click. But what I like best is the card sharing feature. You can easily and safely send a friend, family member, or coworker a Privacy virtual card with just an email, and Privacy will handle the rest. It's also great for small business owners to safely share expenses with a team. Head to privacy.com/breakingbanks and sign up for an account. New customers will automatically get $5 to spend on your first purchase. Go to privacy.com/breakingbanks and sign up now.
The Finovate podcast is your home for interesting conversations and insights from Finovate's global conference series. I'm Greg Palmer. Join me as I interview leading innovators, bankers, analysts, venture capitalists, and more to get their thoughts and predictions on the future of financial technology. Find us wherever you normally listen to podcasts or at provoke.fm.
Our actions have impact. It's easy to forget how everyday small actions can ladder up to very big things. Who would have thought a few messages on a subreddit about GameStop would become a national phenomenon that pitted Wall Street versus Main Street? This segment is not about GameStop or Robinhood, but I would like to ask, what's in your wallet? Or maybe a better question is, what's in your 401k? Impact investing is sometimes confused with philanthropy. Our next guest, Jacob Haar, managing partner of Community Investment Management, an impact investment firm that provides debt capital to fintech companies that support underserved small businesses, thinks impact is a multiplier, not a trade-off. This conversation covered everything from the importance of friction to misnomers about access. It turns out the lessons he learned in Azerbaijan doing microfinance for Save the Children is also applicable 2 decades later in the U.S. And now here's Jacob. So Jacob, first, why don't we start, because they're common words, but not a common household name. What does community investment management do?
Thanks, Jason. Community investment management is an institutional impact investment manager. So we take capital from endowments, foundations, families, et cetera, across the United States that are looking to both generate financial return and also create meaningful social impact and support innovation and lending for underserved communities. And we do that as a credit investor, meaning that unlike a lot of folks who are investing in financial technology, we're not putting venture money into startup fintechs. We're helping them achieve scale and demonstrate what they're doing by funding the growth of their portfolios.
And so, like, we're talking commercial level, not consumer kind of impact in terms of, like, the amount of money and where you're making that investment, correct?
That's right. So we've put more than $1 billion out through fintechs to underserved communities. The majority of that has been to small businesses and small medium enterprises. But we also focus on underserved low-income communities, particularly immigrant communities, communities of color, as well as looking at underserved students who can potentially transform the trajectory of their lives if they were able to get investments in their future. And I think that's a lot. If you really just want to synthesize it, it's fundamentally lending is about providing people with opportunities to create wealth as opposed to exacerbating structural inequity, which got us to this point in time before that. And so I think a lot of what we try to do at Community Investment Management is think how financial services can allow people to succeed based on their capabilities, which are equally distributed, not opportunities, which are very unequally distributed.
So I'm curious, how do you go about measuring, impact? And like, what is your report back to your investors
look like, you know, related, you know, to the kinds of impacts that you're able to have in democratizing this?
Impact is most measurable when you're talking about specific dollars into the hands of a certain number of borrowers. But in some ways, I look at that as one of the least compelling impacts, because if you break it apart, for us, there's, all right, we put X dollars into the hands of Y number of small businesses, underserved communities, et cetera. We create jobs, we, right, through providing that financing. But I think if you take it a step above, what you also see as really compelling, at least in my view around impact, is demonstrating and scaling new products, new ways of trying to reach, understand, de-risk, and lower the cost of serving people. And so whether that's just money that we might invest, it's also thinking about categories. I mean, look at what, for example, Prosper and Lending Club did to the market. I mean, Marcus came in, and you know, that in itself is also impact, to show that there are new product sets that other folks will crowd in and follow. And then the highest level of impact, I think, that we think about and prioritize is about structural change. Like, how do you actually get policymakers involved? How do you think about enabling the environment so that innovation, responsible innovation for the underserved, can flourish, but also that we have guardrails to make sure that innovation doesn't just mean new and innovative ways to take advantage of people, right? And so you have to think about impact as like the money that we're putting in people's hands, but also the products that we're trying to test and launch, and generally the environment in which innovative products for the underserved can be responsible and try to solve a lot of the pain points.
You know, I don't know that we talk enough about the double-edged sword that can be access, right? That financial technology can create access, but there can be downsides. Like, in some regards, Dan Egan, behavioral economist from Betterment, was on a few weeks ago, and we were talking about this idea of actually inserting friction sometimes is very beneficial. This idea of making it as easy as a button, that, you know, there's a lot going on with Robinhood right now, and I don't want to make this a jump on the anti-Robinhood bandwagon. People can go read Ron Shevlin's article in Forbes on that, does a great job. But friction, you know, many times does exist for a good purpose. And Dan used the example of people looking to actually, once they've hit a goal, kind of cash out. That if you insert some friction, kind of a cooling off period, they tend to make more rational choices that are in their best interest. I'm curious if, you know, you're hinting at that pretty strongly in this idea of, you know, there needs to be almost the moral compass in terms of the, what is this accomplishing that comes with fintech? I'm curious how you think about that, and what's your role at CIM in empowering that?
It's a great point. Access we talk a lot in financial inclusion about access to financial services, right? But access to financial services is only a positive if it's access to responsible financial services. The last thing we want is access to predatory financial services. Yeah. And I think often we don't delineate and distinguish as much as we should when we do talk about access. So, we absolutely have to make sure that when we talk about financial inclusion, we're also talking about financial health. We're ultimately looking at, are people better off as a result of this product? And if the answer is yes, then access is a key metric to understand that we're doing something, we're on the right track here. But if the answer is not necessarily, we're actually extracting value out of the customer, then, you know, I think we really need to question whether we want access to products like that. And that's where regulators need to step in to try to create a fair playing field. But, you know, on the purpose of friction, I mean, I do think that is interesting. When you looked at the early days of peer-to-peer lending, there were two stories that were going on merged into one, right? It was about, hey, anyone can invest a few dollars and lend to your community. And so it was about capital formation. And it was also about, we have a new digital way to lend to people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the time, I remember what was quite interesting and compelling about fintech for us was thinking about the way that we were reaching people, right? And customer acquisition, the way that we were getting alternative data, the way that we were getting access to undertapped collateral, and the way that we're lowering operating costs, all of which are pain points, which adds to cost when you deal with the underserved. The capital formation piece, I think that we have a very robust capital system, and not to say there isn't room for improvement, but we certainly are not focused at all about thinking about how capital is formed and decreasing the guardrails and sophistication for investing in things that are new and innovative. And really, in many cases, you need to have a sophisticated due diligence intermediary providing somewhat of a gatekeeper role.
Yeah. What are some of the examples that get you going, you know, when you think about where gatekeepers can be important still, whether those be technological or human gatekeepers still? Are there places that, you know, you look at and you say, this seems like a dangerous slope that we're beginning to slide down in terms of creating access?
I think that the where gatekeepers play a valuable role would generally be when I look at the challenge when you have an unregulated broker market. I mean, so often you do see in alternative lending sales-driven organizations where what is being led is less around underwriting capacity repay, an appropriate product for an appropriate customer, and more a question of, can the sale be made? Can the customer take terms where there's not as much clarity and transparency and you know, obfuscation of various different terms and conditions? And that's where I think that fintech, certain companies have been real leaders in providing transparency. But we've seen also, you know, the sort of old school, many merchant cash advance and other lenders that are out there that, you know, some of which are on the periphery of fintech, I think are not doing a good enough job at telling customers what they need to know. And so, you know, making sure that brokers are required to provide fully transparent information, I think is really important. And in fact, seeing some regulation come down that requires the same protections for those types of disclosures are necessary. And so, you know, we don't necessarily want armies of brokers going around that are not being regulated, describing the terms and conditions of various different innovative fintech products. We actually need to make sure that there's accountability and transparency within the system.
Well, and I think this is one of the greatest promises of fintech, not only is the ability to provide transparency, but also to capture the, you know, the measurability, to your point around, you know, when we throw out financial health, you know, it's an easy term. I like to talk about the financial outcomes. Like, is it the outcome that was intended? Did it have a net improvement for that person's life? You know, the idea of doing it digitally does make it a lot more clear, measurable, transparent in terms of whether it was intended. And, you know, is there some kind of obfuscation, you know, going around? So when you think about this new administration coming in and, you know, you have your personal wish list, you know, over the next 4 years, where do you think the Biden administration should focus on, you know, promoting more of this outcome-based, you know, and driving greater change here?
I think the Biden administration has a great opportunity to build off of what we've seen on a bipartisan level of engagement with fintech from both the Obama administration as well as the Trump administration. I mean, we saw, you know, the OCC fintech charter, Thomas Curry, you know, was leaning in with fintech during the Obama years. Clearly, you know, Brian Brooks and others during the Trump administration were working on a lot of fintech issues. But I think what we're seeing with the Biden administration is a real opportunity for that bipartisanship where, for example, we saw during the depths of the COVID crisis in the summer of 2020, PPP and fintechs getting the ability to actually originate PPP loans to small businesses because they have the access. Right, we couldn't not provide the fintechs with the ability to reach the small business owners, and particularly the small business owners who were smaller, Black small businesses, women small businesses. These, we had a difficult time going through banking channels because of how broken our banking system is at serving the most underserved small business community, whereas fintechs actually had good reach within that. So Isabel Guzman, who I think is a fantastic nominee for the SBA, she in California, we've worked with her, and she's been a part of engaging with fintechs, but very much focused on responsible practices and conditions and how that is a way to reach small business owners. So, you know, between CRA modernization, we have an opportunity so that we don't have the Fed on one end of the spectrum and FDIC and OCC on the other. We can bring that together in a Biden administration. We can have bipartisan legislation come out that protects small businesses. While also, we don't have a choice other than to use innovation to reach small businesses who right now are still in a crisis from what's going on with COVID and afterwards. So I think that we've had a bit of polarization over the last 6 to 8 years at least in this respect. And I'm, as a pretty pessimistic person, I would say I'm optimistic about what we can see if, in fact, we look at fintech and small business support. I mean, just look at Todd Young, right? Republican senator from Indiana, asking Isabel Guzman, who is a very progressive SBA administrator, who's being nominated, and they both agree on the importance of fintech to reach small businesses. And I think we have to build off of that as dealing with the post-COVID recovery that we're going to need to see.
Yeah, well, and I think we look at Chairman McWilliams and what she's doing with the FDIC and pushing banks to modernize and just say, you do need to evaluate your use of technology and your practices, to remain relevant, and the importance of, if we don't do that, we lose kind of a critical anchor. Now, I'm curious, I'd love for you to tell the story of how you ended up in impact investing, because I think your roots actually are very telling as to the worldview that you maintain about, the importance of impact and the importance of technology.
I never expected to be in financial services. So After graduate school, I was in Azerbaijan working with refugees, providing community development through Save the Children, which is a global humanitarian organization. And I started doing microcredit, i.e. making small loans to microenterprises that were started by refugees out of necessity. And I was really blown away by the difference between providing community development grant dollars and giving people an opportunity to go out and build businesses by making microloans. And it was the early 2000s, and it really set me on a course of thinking about how, with enough perseverance and dedication, creativity, we could go to folks who have the worst access to financial services and solve friction and pain points, not with one silver bullet, but rather through just trying to figure out and ideating and testing and learning different solutions to deal with the unique challenges they might have. And that could be, nomadic herders in Mongolia. That could be underserved customers in the United States. I think people don't, what actually brought me to the United States after working, providing credit to a over 35 countries we worked in emerging markets, doing specialty lending, microcredit, SME finance. I came to the U.S. out of what I was seeing in the peer-to-peer market, following essentially the development of how fintech has the ability to solve some of these pain points because of the digital transformation of society and commerce. Like, our world has been changing, clearly, for a number of years. It's been accelerating like crazy in COVID, and barriers to adoption are falling away. And so much innovation goes into solving the greatest market efficiencies, which exist for customers who ultimately live in day-to-day in emerging market here in the U.S. I mean, I think we forget that. We think, oh, the U.S. is such a rich country, so well-served. It's very poorly served. I mean, 25% of the United States is unbanked or underbanked. And even for the folks who are not part of that 25%, you know, half of the people in this country, and we particularly see this under COVID, are living without support, not able to go except from paycheck to paycheck, very little savings. And there are many ways that we can try to understand them better, improve the cost structure, and de-risk providing them with financial services. And so I think, you know, we're not as far away from many emerging markets here in the United States as people may assume. And it's important to deeply engage with the underserved. And that's where innovation is headed. Innovation goes to the lowest, you know, the lowest hanging fruit, which is ultimately people who have the worst services. And so there's this laboratory innovation that is springing up and needs funding and direction. And particularly for impact investors, I think it is incumbent on us to get involved, put capital to work, and try to shape the future that we want to be a part of. Because we can't necessarily just sit idly by and hope that nonprofits are going to solve the challenges. We need to engage with the markets, and we need to put our values within our investment dollars to drive billions of dollars in the right direction.
Now, if you wanted, you know, to make this shift happen, like you get the, whether you're emperor for the day or have a magic wand that you can say, want to change part of the shape of how this dynamic plays out, what would you go do?
You know, I think that if I had a magic wand, I think at the end of the day, it's, you know, folks just, you know, there was a great book that C.K. Prahlad wrote called The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. And my co-founder, Michael Hoganson, wrote the chapter on microfinance in it. But it was a seminal work, and the late C.K. Prahlad was an incredible luminary of this, which was just about, it's about dedication to this part of the market. You know, so I think at the end of the day, people just need to be aware that, you know, the folks who are less fortunate are not less fortunate because they don't deserve good services or products. It's because we haven't done the hard work and put in the creativity to figure out how to do it well. And there is a lot of value for entrepreneurs to focus their attention on solving those pain points. There's money to be made by providing them with great services. And that's where we see a ton of innovation. But, you know, I think if you're an entrepreneur out there and you're looking for your next business model, go look at the underserved. Figure out how to solve pain points, how to give them better products and services. And there's a great business model to be made, and it's a long-term sustainable business model. Because when you are making money because the underlying customer is ultimately having a great return on investment, that ultimately is a financial ecosystem that we all want to be a part of. I think, you know, the gambling and the zero-sum gain model of finance is one that, you know, I hope that we can evolve past, because at the end of the day, there is a lot of money to be made from making the pie bigger, which can be done by reducing pain points and lowering cost of getting financial services to folks who are just overlooked and overpriced.
Well, and I think there's And even not only is that better business, which I think is important, you know, to look at, you know, I think the level of interconnectedness that we find in the markets and the speed with which these things move, you know, 2008 being a great example of this. When we look at starting in 2018, Larry Fink of BlackRock's letter, you know, to CEOs saying, you know, this idea of thinking at a macro level of our impact on an ecosystem, you know, we are our greatest existential threat. And it turns out, like, there's one side we can choose, which is a zero-sum game, which is a race to the bottom. Or, as it turns out, like you just articulated so wonderfully, this, it also can be really good business to look at these tools and say, instead of playing the zero-sum game, how can I solve problems for others who haven't had that benefit before?
Couldn't agree more, Jason. I think that, look, like, we reject the idea that, oh, impact investing, it's this nice little cute philanthropic thing. I mean, this is where the long-term business models are being born out of, where if you look at it from a profit maximizing perspective, we are maximizing profit over a long-term period. If you are extracting value out of a customer, you might make a lot of money in a very short-term period, but you're going to create adverse selection by continuing to burn out your customers, needing new customers. We see the damage when the music stops at a particular point in time, and investing in an ecosystem that is sustainable, where, you know, people are ultimately improving their lives, you have their loyalty and can sell lots of products and services to them over a long-term period of time. And, you know, we see how it ends in financial services, where people are short-term. You have to exercise restraint. But, and you know, human beings are at their nature struggle with balancing short-term versus long-term thinking, for sure. But there's a lot of really compelling business models that will be built and succeed. And we're seeing that already, I think, with a lot of the fintech for inclusion companies. And so I do think that we need regulators to both allow room for innovation, but also put guardrails in place to make sure that that innovation is not irresponsible. And so it's a combination of both push and pull, of allowing for some innovation, but also making sure that we're clear on what we as a society are willing to accept and not accept in terms of collateral damage.
So I love the book recommendation. Where else do you go when you read up on impact investing? If someone wants to delve deeper either into being more inclusive in those opportunities, serving the underbanked, thinking about impact investing more broadly, where do you suggest people start their journey, either online or on books?
There's a couple of organizations that have great, great resources. So one is called the Global Impact Investing Network. It actually coined the term impact investing through a report that Ahmed Burry, who's the CEO, did when he was at Monitor Group for Rockefeller, and as part of the research to set that up. And they've got, for anyone interested in impact investing, I would say go to the GIIN, the GIN, Global Impact Investing Network webpage. The other one that I would point folks to is an organization called Impact Capital Managers, which are venture capital firms like myself, Community Investment Management, who are looking at impact investing and thinking about not needing to give up return. In fact, return being driven by the alpha that is within impact strategies. And so I would, there's a lot of great books, but I would say go to those two organizations and you can find all kinds of information. I think people are often surprised when they see that impact investments often outperform traditional investments. And as you think about going into a future with climate change, with profound inequality, there are definitely ways to align your money with your values without compromising on having retirement savings and other things.
Yep. Well, fantastic. If people want to learn more about community investment management, where can they go to learn about you and your journey and what you do?
Well, certainly folks should feel free to reach out. And our website is cim-llc.com. And we've been profiled in a few different articles. We have always participated at Lendit, and I would say Lendit is something that we get very involved in terms of the financial health track. And I really appreciate you having me on, Jason, just so people can hear about what we do in impact investing and why it relates to fintech and financial inclusion.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for joining us, Jacob.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.